Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high performance organization with your host, Joseph Paris. Welcome to A State of Readiness. Today's guest is Carolyn Bondier, who's a process director, director of process development and program management for Kone Modernization Business Line. She was born in France with her first degree in business being earned in France. She moved to Finland at 20 years old to complete a BBA in international business, fell in love with the country, and after some struggle to find work, started the career in document coordination in Nokia as a subcontractor, then focused on sales and marketing development for Finnish-based SciTech Group, and then started her MBA International Business Management and moved to Kone in IT and process development. Here she worked with the organization in CRM domain, moved on to the business side 5 years ago, driving business transformation around the tendering and ordering process and systems. 2 years ago, she took a newly created role of process development and program management for modernization business line. Loves to travel and to volunteer at Red Cross and fundraising as the fundraising manager for the Red Cross. Her passion is to support organizations in achieving their vision for growth in operational excellence. Her focus is on how improvement and performance happens, how teams succeed. And with the strong leadership skills and change management capabilities, she's been able to systemically drive teams, solutions, and programs towards success. Welcome to the show, Caroline. How are you doing today?
Thank you, Joseph. Thank you for having me. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
That's awesome. That's, you know, so you fell in love with Finland and specifically in Helsinki.
Yes, I did. So it's been 16 years now that I've been in Finland, and I originally came just for 9 months, but fell in love with the country and the way of working, way of studying, everything here. So I decided to stay.
And where are you from in France?
Quite close to Bordeaux. It's in the southwest, wine region for those who like to drink red wine. So a small town called Périgueux.
Yeah, thanks. My favorite wine is from the Rhône region, you know, the Châteauneuf-du-Pape, and very robust reds, I guess, is my preference. Mm-hmm. And of course, in Helsinki, I guess you've had to change to vodka now, right? That's their national drink?
I actually have no idea because, like I said, I'm a wine lady, so I must say I haven't been following too much on the vodka. We have what we call Koskenkorva, which is a clear liquor that could be perhaps compared to the vodka, but I'm afraid I'm not very big connoisseur in those type of drinks.
Yeah. So, you know, how did you gravitate towards the discipline of operational excellence? You know, obviously you started off in business and in IT, but how did you evolve and focus your passions on operational excellence?
Well, actually, that's a very good question, and I think I have a bit maybe of an unusual journey in that sense, because basically I didn't even label myself as an operational excellence person until the beginning of the year. And I will explain why a little bit, but essentially I've always been someone who tries to see what we can do better, faster, smarter, regardless if it's in the personal life or in my work life or in my volunteer activities. But I've never taken any type of certification. And obviously my studies were more on the business side, not particularly strong focus on operational excellence. And I also think that generally speaking in Finland, this overall operational excellence concept was not particularly strong until let's say some years ago. Well, not as obvious as one could think. It was still very much focused on manufacturing and these kind of processes, which were a little bit further away from me, even though Kone is a manufacturing company. So essentially, I had a bit of an identity crisis, having been, you know, in the customer side. I was in then the IT side, then I was on the business side, and I was trying to figure out myself that, okay, what is it that I do? What is it that I'm actually about? who is me as a person in my work context. So I decided to do a little bit of career coaching, and throughout the different discussion and exercises with this career coach, we realized that basically everything I was doing, almost since the day I was born, to be frank, was gravitating around this type of excellence concept and excellence philosophy. So always trying to find a way to do something better and not just living the status quo or the sort of established practices. So this is why I'm maybe not the typical operational excellence person, and it's been more of a journey to now come to this point where I think that I am an operational excellence practitioner and believer.
So, you know, you define yourself as an excellence ideologist.
Yes.
What does that mean? What is an excellence ideologist?
Well, again, you know, as human beings, I think we like to put labels on each other quite a lot. But I was really struggling to find even a label for myself. And I was really having these revelations around this operational excellence. But then the more I was reading about it, the more I was like, actually, it's not still quite there yet in terms of who I am and how I function in a way. And it took a little bit of like digging around until I found something that I was happy with. But essentially, the excellence part is basically, it doesn't matter if it's a new business concept or if it's a major transformation or a continuous improvement. Excellence is about finding ways to do something better tomorrow than how you are doing it today. So again, the better, faster, smarter, whatever it may be. So I think that in that sense, I don't like to limit this view of the operational excellence. And I think, again, the challenge is that in Finland, there is still a bit of a mindset that the operational excellence is limited to the manufacturing world. Whereas I think in other countries, and certainly in your book, it's very obvious that it's much more than that. But I decided to drop this operational part of the operational excellence a little bit early on this year, after realizing that, okay, people are starting to ask me that, are you a Lean Six Sigma certified and do you work in factory and these kind of things. I've been talking with a lot of other people though here in Finland, and I think this mentality is now starting to change. So people are seeing beyond the word operations. So that's the excellence part. And in terms of the ideologist part, I think that, you know, anyone who is smart is capable of applying the theories, the methods, use the tools, everything that has to do with operational excellence. But if you want to succeed, I think, in this career in the long run, and if you want to be really good at what you're doing and empowering others to also come on the journey with you, you have to have it in your heart. You have it as part of your DNA. It's almost like a religion or a philosophy in that sense. And that's why I'm using the term ideologist, because practitioner for me is not enough. It's one thing to practice, it's another thing to believe, to really, in a way, dedicate your life to it and dedicate your career to it. And that's how I realized that I've been actually doing this almost by accident in the last 15 years of my career, at least. And I intend to do so until the day I retire in my work life, regardless of what position I may have.
Yeah, it's, you know, to me, you know, when I think about operations versus operational, you know, operational is more of a condition, you know, where operations are sort of like the individual processes and functions, usually linear in nature within an organization. I think where people get confused between, you know, like say Lean and Six Sigma, you know, which focuses on operations and improving operations, you know, operational is, you know, how do we get an organization to work better as an organization?
Exactly.
You know, and then, you know, you talked about empowerment, or you mentioned empowerment just a moment ago. You know, isn't it a challenge? You know, companies and managers and leaders talk about empowerment, but they have a fear of releasing, you know, so they really don't empower because they're always, you know, double checking or cross checking the people that they're supposed to be empowering. So how do you make sure that you don't fall into that trap?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a tough thing, and I must say that it gets perhaps easier with age. Also, I don't think that, you know, in the early days, as you mentioned, I was in Nokia as a publishing assistant. You can't necessarily empower people, though you can find ways to continuously improve and then show good practices to your colleagues, but you're not really in the empowerment stage. So I think that's something, first of all, that comes with age and with time in a company. And how to actually do it, I think it's really about delegating. And perhaps some of my colleagues that may listen to this podcast may think that, okay, really, Caro? but I do tend to delegate quite a lot. And I like to have a mix in my team of junior, but also senior people. And with the junior ones, I tend to give them challenges that perhaps other managers may not dare to. So I think a lot of trying and failing is also important in the empowerment path. And then also I've been involved in a number of mentoring programs. And I think that it's always important to educate and inspire. It's, of course, a self-learning journey, but also then to do it for others is very important. And especially because myself and my team, we are in this change world. So we already know from the get-go that we are not going to win the popularity contest, right? I mean, the change agents, we know it. We are facing organizations that want to change, but either they don't know how to or they are scared, and there's different people in the organization. Some may be supporters, but also many are detractors. So how we can like impact this cultural change cannot be just coming from one leader or one manager in a program office. That has to be that the entire team is empowered to do so, because I'm not in every single meeting where my team is. I'm not in every single deployment, every single program. So I think that's really critically important that we are able to empower people who are in these operational excellence organizations or transformation organization or whatever is the name of your team. But as long as you're doing change management to a degree, I think it's very, very important that every single member of the team is empowered to represent, to educate, to inspire, and of course, to lead those changes.
It, wouldn't you say, though, you know, with empowerment, and you talk about empowerment, you talk about delegation, but ultimately, you know, when we empower and when we delegate, we have to, in order to be effective, we have to establish some level of trust,
yeah.
Right? We have to be able to release and just truly release. And I think that's a big challenge for people because, you know, at the end of the day, we as leaders are held accountable to the people that, you know, that you know, we're beholden to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we want to make sure that, you know, as we release and as we delegate, you know, that the people are going to be able to do successfully complete the tasks for which they're assigned or to which they're assigned. And, you know, how do you establish that level of trust between you and your teammates and among the teammates themselves?
I don't know if there is any sort of like method or sort of secret recipe. I think this is maybe something that I learned with time. And in that sense, like very practically speaking, to give a silly example, but I have one-to-one meetings with each even individual team member every Friday, and we look together at what they've done throughout the week, what they are supposed to do the next week, where are the areas where they feel that they are comfortable to manage, and then where are the parts maybe where I need to support. We have, of course, regular touch points throughout the week, but that meeting for me is like really, really essential that we take an hour, we sit down, we have a relaxed conversation, we go through everything. And I think that for them as well, they know that they are on one hand trusted with the things that maybe they master the most. But at the same time, if there is things where they're a little bit less comfortable, then they know that I'm here to back them up. And we have a fantastic department. I'm very, very lucky to work for the modernization business line in Kone. So we're all very, very supportive of each other. We're all, I think, empowering each other. And of course, we've had to go through pretty significant changes ourselves. So it's been a learning journey. And as you mentioned, my position, for instance, was created 2 years ago. And before that, we were a very project-based organization, but now we are a portfolio organization. So we have basically a modernization portfolio, and under that, we have nine program owners. And then underneath that, we have something like 20 development projects, 20 deployment projects, and give or take 500 rollouts to our frontline business units in a space of 3 years. So to go from a project organization to a portfolio organization with this type of structure and all the new methodologies that were given to us and so on has been could have been a complete failure if we had not empowered each other, trusted each other, worked together as a team, And you talk in your book a lot about capacity, but also capabilities. And I think that's what we've been trying to do, bring not only that we have the right number of people and the right profile of the people, but that also that we are bringing these capabilities where people are able themselves to be able to make the right decision, to make them in due time, and then to have a bit of this cultural change where they are more and more adaptive and they are more and more able also to bring the change management to our front lines. Because at the end of the day, of course, the end game is that we have business benefit realization, but also that we have better employee experience and, of course, customer experience. So this has been very fascinating for me, 2.5 journey now with KONE in this new era of what we call the KONE way, and how we've been able to really as a team empower each other towards the success. And there is a long way to go. There are challenges, of course. But I think it's been really interesting.
Now, KONE is headquartered there in Finland, and the average person wouldn't recognize the company or the name or even know what it does. I got to introduce to you some months ago, and you told me about the company. I was in the States. I was at Newark Airport, and I was taking an escalator. And right there on the platform at the bottom was, KONE. And it's like, wow, yes. Here I am in Newark, okay? Yeah. And I know this company. I would not have recognized it. I would not have noticed it had I not, been introduced to you. So,
right.
Maybe if you could just tell a little bit or share a little bit about, who KONE is and what do they do?
Yeah. Bouncing a little bit on your anecdote first, we are, I think, very discreet in that sense that, like you say, people don't necessarily notice KONE, but you should know that every single day, 1 billion people in the world are using KONE equipment to move from point A to point B. So 1 billion people are using our equipment without even knowing most of the time that it's actually from KONE. So that's a little bit reflecting to what you said about your airport experience. But then, a couple of facts about KONE. So the company was founded as KONE in 1910. So it's going to be 110-year-old next year. And in 2018, we had a revenue of 9.1 billion euros, and we have roughly 57,000 employees. Our operations as KONE are basically anywhere from the US to China and everything in between and up and down. and we also have a very, very extensive network of distributors. So it's a pretty a sizable business in that sense. And we have essentially two main focus on the business. So basically this new equipment business, which is mainly for architects and developers. So there we provide elevators, escalators, automatic doors, building access control, and many other people flow solutions. And then we have our service business, which is more targeted towards building owners, facility managers, housing associations, where we modernize and maintain the equipment throughout the life cycle. And we also have digital services, such as predictive maintenance. And that's also been a very interesting journey with the digital services, because throughout the 110 years history of the company, the first 90 years were essentially about doing a good, solid, robust machine and equipment that is somewhat homogeneous with somewhat same ways of working, but it was not hyper harmonized. That wasn't the number one goal. Number one goal was to make a good product, make a good service to the customer, and that was of course a great achievement, but that was also in a way essentially it. And 20 years ago, with the introduction of our ERP, I think that already sort of shook the world a little bit, because we had to harmonize a lot of our processes, and that was a big first step into this sort of excellence era and harmonization era. But also we need to continuously improve, and there were big transformations in the company happening, particularly on the IT side, of course, introductions of systems like the CRM, CPQs, things like that. And then more specifically in the last 10 years, we've seen, so that was more about our internal journey, our internal transformation towards the excellence. And of course, there was a positive impact on customers, but it was still very inside in, so to say. But then in the last 10 years, we have really been understanding that our customers' expectations are completely different. I mean, the whole digital world is taking everyone by storm, not just Konem. And there you can't have the sort of slow motion, perfect type of development or improvement. You've got to be fast, you've got to be assertive, you've got to be prepared. You need to have the right teams to be able to make the decisions and get things out there. And of course, that is a huge cultural change as well, because our workforce, again, out of 57,000 employees, a vast majority of this workforce is in the field. So they are guys who have been very well installing, maintaining elevators, escalators for a big chunk of their career. And all of a sudden, we're talking about clouds, digital services, predictive maintenance, and so on and so forth. So we're really into this transformation journey right now, which is absolutely fascinating. And connecting to your book, The State of Readiness, I've really, again, enjoyed that book so much, because I think it really reflects what a lot of companies are going through today, particularly because of digital transformation.
Earlier in the conversation, you mentioned the Kone Way.
Yes.
As your business operating model, what's the Kone Way, and how does it support the company strategy?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, basically, like you said, the strategy is the why and the what, right? And then the Kone Way is really the how. So it's one could almost call it a handbook, though it's a bit reductive maybe. But it's essentially how we operate as a company, and I think it's a quite well-referenced model, in at least in the Nordics. I don't know if in the US anyone would have ever heard of it, but essentially it really supports us into achieving our results. We've had challenges, of course, with it, but it's been, I think, in my view at least, it's really a fantastic tool in a way for us. It's got seven sub-elements. So we've got processes, organizations, roles, data, IT tools, governance, and business performance. And it's a way, a harmonized way, basically, for all our teams across Kone to work in a harmonized way, and always first and foremost towards the better employee and customer experience. So we have a portal, a QPR portal, like most companies, and you have then the possibility as a newbie, or if your company's been newly acquired by Kone or your distributor, to really understand full chain, that everything that we do, who is doing it, how we record it, what are the data flows, and it's to a level where I think it's quite detailed, without being, of course, down to the field in the tool XYZ, but it is really, really quite quite extensive, and it's used also, I think, more than what people think, even in our own company. So it's really great. I think in terms of the benefits, it's been especially on this governance, because of course with governance we can make decisions faster, and also we can make decisions that cross portfolios. We make sure that we serve the best interest of the company, because of course we have like many different portfolios. We have business line portfolios, we have logistics, we have sourcing, HR, finance, etc. And if we're just looking at it from each own portfolio's perspective, we might define a strategy for our portfolio that we think is supporting the overall company strategy. But that's only our view. So there's been a really big effort in the last couple of years, and I'm really happy to participate in that, to have this cross-portfolio view, so that we are able to make sure that throughout the whole chain, we are all on the same page and we are all going towards the same goal. Is it always working perfectly? Of course not. But at least we are going into that direction, and we're really making like a lot of effort and investment to get there. Of course, in the challenges, there is, of course, as I said, we are operating from US to China and everything above and in between. So we do have market and offering diversity, and that is just the nature of our industry. We cannot cater the needs of the customers in the same way everywhere. There's many business where it's possible, but I don't believe for ours it is. So we have to find the ways that we can streamline and harmonize as much as possible, and of course bring these continuous improvements to the mass. But we also need to be able to sometimes have the nuances, and that can become then very tricky. for the change management and for the benefits realization. Because of course, the change management, you know, just like the basic change management where you're changing something, but everywhere across your organization is tough enough. But then when you have to understand the specificities of the market or the customers and adapt that change is even more complicated.
So, you know, thinking globally, acting locally comes to mind. And, you know, it's, I think a company that wants to cookie cutter, wants to cut and paste a way of doing business around the globe is going to fail.
Right.
Because there's always, you know, local customs, local infrastructure issues, local variables that don't exist universally that have to be considered when acting, you know, in any given region or location.
Yeah.
So you know, you talk about, you know, there's a gigantic body of knowledge out there dealing
yes.
with, you know, continuous improvement and operational excellence, and people have their different, you know, orientations. And you know, I think that to be successful, we have to be almost lifelong learners. You know what I mean? It's just, you know, we want to dedicate,
absolutely.
You know, put aside some time, either daily or weekly, where we explore. So, you know, you have all these different, you know, OPEX and CI philosophies, the methodologies, the terminologies, the organization, organizational recommendations, and so on. You know, how do you gather these things, and then how do you distill them down to, you know, what's important to you or what resonates to you, and then how do you turn that into action? I know that's a big.
Yeah, that's a big question, but I think we have various ways. I mean, I don't know if there is a single recipe when you have a company of 57,000 people, but I think that there's a lot of ways. So first of all, if we are looking at it, and it's not just for Corning, I think it's valid for anywhere else, but if we're looking at it, first of all, from the product and offering point of view, we have, of course, like established processes for feedback loop. And then whatever feedback we get from the field, then we have internal processes to then, in a very systematic way, incorporate these changes into our continuous development pipeline. So that's one thing. Then, if I'm looking a little bit from the IT world, it's the same. I mean, of course, every solution owner may have a different preference. Some are organizing monthly meeting with the key users. Some are having Trello boards or whichever other type of ways to collect this kind of information. But again, if we're looking at it from how this Corning way is supporting that, we have so established processes for this kind of feedback looping, and then we have a very strict gate control so that we are able to assess that if it's a small thing, then it goes in the continuous development pipeline, but there it will still go through some gates. So we have different gates depending on different type of requests. Or then if it's big transformation projects, then it's more about that comes in a way from a lingering need that is just too big to assess through change requests or feedback. And then we, portfolio managers, business owners, program owners, sit down together and do, of course, a lot of roadmapping exercises. The roadmapping are not just done in the ivory tower. We have different level of organization in the company, so our frontline business unit, then we have our area, or in some companies called regions, and then we have the corporate. So, for instance, Finland would be a unit, Central and Northern Europe is an area, and then we have the global. So the frontline units are supposed to give their feedback, of course, to the areas, and then we work with the areas in all the road mapping exercise. We have a lot of touch points. And again, depending if it's a development project, deployment project, or just a change request that comes through this continuous development pipeline, we have gates. That, of course, can hinder speed. So we have to always be mindful that how much control and how much gates do we want to have. But I think it's also brought a lot of quality, and we are a bit different business perhaps than others in a sense where the safety is an absolute number one concern and priority for us. So we are not just like, you know, delivering software to an app to some people out there. We're moving 1 billion users every day, as I mentioned earlier. So we need to find a balance in the digital services. Maybe it's easier to have this speed. We can do a lot of agile and have this kind of iterative modes of improving. But then there is also other part of our organization where we need to be a bit controlled. So long story short, I think to answer your question, we learn every day, first of all, about this kind of feedback loops and this kind of ways of getting this mass of information into a deliverable output. But we have good mechanisms today. Again, probably not perfect, but there is a pretty good base, and we also need to make that base evolve. So our Koneway models are evolving all the time. Our methodologies are evolving all the time. They are not static. So we need to be adaptive, and it's a lifelong journey for sure.
So what are some of your personal, you spoke about, you know, how Koneway builds its knowledge base. You know, what are some of your personal habits? You know, you seem like very inquisitive and very individual. And you know, what are some of your habits for, you know, gathering, you know, or getting this information on your radar, identifying which pieces that you want to learn about, and then going to about learning it?
Well, I ask a lot of questions, which again doesn't always win me the Miss Popularity contest, but I think that's still kind of a good habit in a way, because that really helps me to gather a lot of information, because of course we have a lot of good tools and systems where we can see the change requests, we can see the programs, the project, what's happening where, who is the owner of what. We have a project management tool, for instance, which has made my life at least a lot easier in the last couple of years, because I get the transparency and I get the information. We, of course, have, as mentioned, this kind of road mapping activities. We have this cross-portfolio meetings, workshops, alignments. So that's already like a good source. Then I think the second thing is coming back a little bit to the earlier discussion, that we can't just look into our own portfolios. So in that sense, I'm perhaps in a unique position, because the modernization business is about, you know, changing, let's assume, an elevator by another elevator. So that's very much in the product world. But at the same time, from the philosophy point of view, from the customers we are dealing with and so on, we're very much a service business line. So I have to reconcile these two words of like new equipment business and more product oriented with then our service world. So I'm always trying to ask questions from everywhere and try to make sure I really understand what is going on everywhere. How do we fit in? Because we're a little bit in between these two worlds. And road mapping, I think is really one of the key words. That doesn't support the small improvement and continuous improvement type of journey, but it certainly helps with the bigger transformations. And it's a great communication tool as well, because when we have this sort of like a cross portfolio reviews, for instance, everybody's using the same roadmap templates, and we are able to see that, okay, this is what you guys are doing. We are doing this. We should sync. We are not aligned. You're doing this too early. We're doing this too late. So I think it's... it's a lot about asking questions, forcing people to work in similar ways as well, being a bit of a pain every now and then. Also, again, if I have colleagues listening, hi, you know, because it's tough. I mean, if you want to do this right, again, this whole excellence pursuit, if you want to do it right, you have to have it in your heart. If you just follow the methodologies and stuff, yes, you will fix things, and you probably will gain some productivity and such. But if you want to be truly in this kind of state of readiness, competitiveness, etc., you've got to be on a completely different level. And for that, you need to have 360 view.
So, you know, I guess a couple of questions, follow-up questions here. Mm-hmm. You know, do people need to be certified? I mean, you know, is there a certificate? I mean, you know, people say they're certified in operational excellence, but to me, operational excellence is so wide that it's very difficult to, you know, be certified in something that's so wide, except for maybe it's more, you know, contained application. Mm. So, you know, there's a, you know, an emphasis on training, education, mostly certifications. And I'm sometimes wondering if the certifications are are treating a symptom and not the disease, or if the book smarts you get in certification translate to something that's tangible and pragmatically applicable to an organization. And the follow up to that is, you know, can anybody become, you know, maybe not an expert in OPEX, but do OPEX?
Yeah, I think that, that's a little bit prime example of my philosophy as well, because again, I'm not certified in anything yet. I have the feeling that I have achieved a certain level, at least of practicing that type of principles every day. So definitely I'm not anti-trainings and I'm not anti-certification, to make myself very clear. But I think we also need to demystify a little bit, and we need to make people understand, and that's what I'm trying to do with my team, for instance, and our program owners and an extended network, that you don't have to be certified and know every terminology in the books in order to find, first of all, in your own job, but also around you, ways to just do things, again, smarter, better, faster.
Yeah.
So
I was going to say, you know, perhaps certification is applicable for the people that are on the front line doing the actual improvement. You know, so they need to know the tools and the techniques and how to problem solve. But I think that there's a difference between that and, you know, looking horizontally across the organization, not just vertically.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think very specifically, if we take two programs and two methods, so to say, more specifically, like Agile, for instance, we have Agile certified coaches, or if we take Lean, we have the Six Sigma black belts. We even have actually a Lean Six Sigma program management office, so we take it very seriously. But these guys, they are absolutely brilliant and excellent into looking at a specific domain, right? But then for sure, if we're looking above, so like maybe more people like myself, you need to have this 360 view. So do I have to be a certified Agile coach to understand what Agile is and identify to which of my programs or projects in the portfolio Agile will suit the best? Probably not. And then on the other hand, then the level below is also the same. Like if I have a guy on site who's been installing 20 years, you know, elevators, he has already developed his own method, his own process, how to best install that elevator. And of course, we give those installation methods and we have like a lot of instructions and stuff. But there is a lot of people, especially in repetitive work, where you're going to end up anyhow finding what works the best for you. And you're probably going to invent the best process in a way, the best method that works for yourself. And those guys are not certified in anything other than, of course, like installing elevators. So I think we really need to inspire people also to have the opportunity to speak up, or to have the opportunity to be empowered to do the things the way that they think is the best.
Right,
if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes absolute sense. So I think now we'll take a break. Mm-hmm. And when we come back, we'll talk about, you know, how do you manage conflict, you know, supporters and detractors, you know, what do you think the future holds, and getting some of your, you know, outside of Kone and such like. So let's take a break and we'll be right back. This episode of State of Readiness, sponsored by the Operational Excellence Society, a think tank, a creator and aggregator of knowledge and know-how, serving businesses and professionals who wish to learn more on the various topics which combined comprise the discipline of operational excellence. Learn more at www.opexsociety.org. Welcome back. This is Joseph Paris, and you're listening to State of Readiness. Our guest today is Carolyn Bondier, a Director of Process Development and Program Management for Kone. Welcome back there, Caroline.
Thanks, Joseph.
All right. So, you know, we covered your journey and the Kone journey. You know, what about the future? What does the future hold?
Well, I'm hoping that the future holds a whole lot more of excellence and improvements and transformation, because it's a fun domain to be in. I think, again, if you have it in your heart and if it's really something you believe in, not that you're forced to do, I think it's just open up the world to so many possibilities, because you can do it basically in any company or in any industry. And specifically in Konya, we have so wide array of activities that it's there is always going to be opportunities to improve something and to do something better. And of course, as I mentioned just a little bit earlier, like this whole digital transformation is just something that is so exciting to be part of. We are at the beginning of the journey. We have, of course, excellent services already, particularly in our maintenance, predictive maintenance domain, sorry. But it is realistically the beginning of the journey. So again, for a 110-year-old company, we've been in that space now maybe for commercially at least for a few years, and there's much more to come. So so I think this yeah, taking the people flow to the next level is something that is very, very important to us. And of course, a lot of exciting things by doing all the time more co-creation with our customers and trying to really achieve the best possible customer experience. And I want to highlight also the employee experience. So we have very strong values in the company, and we really believe that at the end of the day also we need to have also our employees happy. So the customer experience is not the only end game. It's of course making sure our employees are excited. So lots of things coming up, lots of new things. We have nothing but endless opportunities to learn all the time. We have, I think, also a new set of exciting offerings that will be coming up all the time at much faster pace than what they used to in the past. So I think it's going to be very exciting.
Faster pace. I mean, that's, you know, that's what I think about when I think about, you know, the value proposition of, you know, operational excellence is, you know, to compress the timeline. You know what I mean? So we have to start making decisions based on less data, less complete data, you know, which means that we have to trust our people, our infrastructure, our value chain, and what they are capable of doing. And I got to also say that, you know, for a company that's 110 years old, or will be in a couple of months, for a company that has that much longevity, and is that large, you know, expansively geographically, as well as the number of employees, to have such a progressive, forward looking perspective rather than living in the past is really something that is often lacking in other companies that are as old and has such a significant footprint as Kone. So that's, you know, that bodes well. Those are good positive factors for successful into the future.
But I think that's why we are listed, ranked, as one of the most innovative companies in the world. So that's, of course, something we are very proud of. And I want to be honest also with the listeners that it has its share of challenges to have these changes. But again, it's on a daily basis, we might be whining a little bit. But if we're looking at the big picture, it's really a great journey to be part of, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, when I'm lecturing at university, and mostly the undergraduates, most of them are system science and industrial engineers, you know, so they're on the path to continuous improvement and whatnot. And, you know, I start off my talk by stating to them that they have probably selected the very worst discipline they could possibly select when it comes to a career. You know, 'cause if you're a carpenter and you're done with the day, you know, done with the job, you go home and you're done, right? And if you're an auto mechanic, the same thing. Even if you're a computer programmer, you know, you leave the office and, you know, you go home. But as continuous improvement professionals, when we leave the office, we're always thinking about You know, why did they do it that way? We go to the grocery store. Why did they stack the groceries the way they stacked it? Why did they lay out the aisles the way they have them laid out? You know, why is that hazardous material on the ground where somebody could slip and fall? You know, we're thinking about this all the time. We leave our jobs and we are still applying our continuous improvement OPEX mindset, you know, basically 24/7.
Yeah.
So when you leave Kone, do you take that mindset with you, or are you able to put it and leave it at Kone?
Well, I'm fortunate enough that I live in a country where things are very well structured, and there is not that many opportunities, perhaps besides the grocery store, like you said, to really find big ways of improvement. So Finland, I think, is very advanced, and everything is very lean and streamlined, so it's quite easy. But as a French, let me tell you, when I go back to France, usually start with the car rental queue at the airport. And I go into the OPEX mode. Like, how can it be possible? You know, and I know it's the same in the US, where I've traveled enough and rented enough cars in my life that I know it's basically everywhere except in Finland. But as soon as I'm in France, usually I'm going to be going mental with that thing. So I'm kind of glad in that sense that I do live in Finland, because I think that indeed I can't leave it at the door of the office. I just have that mindset, like, continuously. And as I said to my mother, we've been discussing those things, and she said that even as a child, I was continuously trying to find ways to optimize my morning routine so I could sleep longer, or optimize my homework so I could have more time to play with my friends. So apparently this is something I'm born with. So definitely can't leave it at the door of the office. But very thankful to be in Finland, where I don't have that many opportunities to really stress about it and look around and be like, why don't they do it like this? It would be so much better like that, and so on. So that's quite good for people like me.
But, you know, you do have interests outside of Kone. I mean, you're involved in a couple of NGOs, and you know, do you take your skill sets and your mindsets, and, you know, how do you replicate that or influence the NGOs in which you're involved?
Yeah, so again, from the daily life point of view, I'm quite fortunate. But then if we're talking about this NGO world, then that's, of course, something where some of my colleagues have been like, how can you survive? You're like the most structured person we know, and it is kind of widely known that NGOs are usually not particularly structured when it comes to volunteer work, at least. And well, 3 years ago, almost 3 years ago, I joined the Finnish Red Cross as a fundraising manager. So I'm organizing all the box collections and companies' collections, a bit like to raise fund for certain causes. And I couldn't find any information, or not that much. And there was a lot of text everywhere, and I couldn't figure out in my mind that, okay, where is the box and where is the arrow, right? Where is my swim lane? Where is my process? So, because that's how I think, that's how my brain is wired. Mind you, everything was in Finnish, and of course I speak Finnish, but it's not my first language, so very difficult to really grasp that, okay, now I'm fundraising manager, what am I supposed to do? So as soon as I started recording whatever bit of information I could find. And then from the first few months, I mean, it was maybe 3 months after I started, I started building an operating model, because I was going crazy. So I literally created processes, data flows, on basic things. Of course, it's a completely different level than a corporate level. It's more about, okay, we need to send the information to the members, and then once we have sent information to members, we send information to facility managers and blah blah blah. But still, I just had to do it. I was compelled to do it. I created myself a Trello board, of course, you know, this kind of like Kanban-like type of a board. And I had a small team, volunteers helping me, and I said, like, listen, guys, like, I can't work otherwise. It's just I'm going to stress, and volunteering should be fun. So either we're going to do it my way, or basically I'm out. And funny enough, they loved it, because for them it's very clear. I need to do this by that date, and once I have finished this, I do the next thing, and it was like making their life much easier. So that was fun. And then, of course, I shared it with our the actual Red Cross staff. So people actually working in the Red Cross that are overseeing our volunteers' activities. And they were like, oh, my God, like, can you come and make like a masterclass about this kind of stuff? Because we need help. So for me, it was funny that for something so simple that originally was just meant for myself to just help gather my thoughts and understand what is the optimal way to do this. In the end, also serve the purpose for other people. So I think it's again an example of how excellence should not be confined in a manufacturing station, but it is really something so much broader, like you were saying earlier. And then the other one has been, I've been part of this International Working Women of Finland network, which was created a couple of months ago with a bunch of absolutely amazing ladies. And we're basically like supporting and promoting the diversity in both gender and cultural background in the Finnish work life. And we went from 20 members in the first month, which was August, to now 2,000 members, which may not sound big for your US audience or German audience, but for Finland is actually a very big deal. So there as well, we've been trying to set up some Kanban board and take one task at a time and try to manage like this intake flow of members. And it's been absolutely fantastic. But again, it became very apparent that we can't do this without processes. We need to have processes because we have cases where people say, okay, can I organize an event? Can I promote this and that business? And we are five people in the board of that network. So we need to agree and set up the rules together and the processes so that we are not answering five different ways to the same request, you know? So again, I think it's a whole lot of common sense. There is nothing like particularly fancy about what I'm saying, but quite naturally, I think you always have this point, whether it's 3 months or it's 3 years or whatever, where you're thinking that, hey, come on, we can do this in a different way. Or in case of new organization, we need to set up the base, that foundation, already now after just the 3 months.
Now, you know, you've been, you know, recognized recently, if I'm not mistaken, for your efforts, right? You've been assigned a leadership role at both of these organizations?
Yes, just last week, actually, I was appointed on the board of both the Red Cross and then this International Working Women of Finland. So it was an interesting week.
Yeah, and already, I mean, you know, KONE has, you know, 20-ish percent of its directors are female, which is, you know, a fairly high percentage, mm-hmm. at least certainly by U.S. standards, but, you know, but you're not Finnish either. You know, you're French.
No.
And so, mm-hmm. you know, to be a director at the director level of KONE, being a French-born female, you know, between that and, you know, these other appointments, these other boards, you know, I would probably say, you know, you're almost a natural-born leader. Leadership comes naturally to you. And it's not so much that you nominate or appoint yourself as leader. Other people are mm-hmm. appointing you as leader, you know, mm-hmm. which is validation. So, you know, I always say that, you know, if, you know, a leader thinks they're a leader and they look behind them and nobody's following, they're not a leader. They're just out for a walk.
Right.
And it looks like there are many people that, if you look behind yourself, are following you. And of course, these people are following you because they want to follow you. They don't mm. have to follow you. Mm. And so that, you know, kudos to you. They're outstanding. I'm very, very impressed.
Well, thanks, Jose. But, you know, it also comes with a price to certain followers that then I've been saying this couple of times. I can be a very big pain. So, you know, it's not always easy. But in that sense, yeah, I mean, I'm not here for self-promotion, obviously. But
yeah.
But I have a certain energy and I like to get things a certain way. And I do like to have this sort of positive progress. Let's move forward. Or at least the end goal is sort of clear. And once you reach the end goal, you set the next end goal and you keep on going. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it can be also, I think, a bit difficult for people around me. I can fully acknowledge that as well. So I don't want to seem like this kind of a superstar or something. I'm a very big realist in that sense. So, yeah.
All right. So we're at the speed round section of our talk here. You ready?
Yes.
All right. So
shoot.
What's the best piece of advice you've ever received, and who gave that to you, if you wanted to share who?
So actually, it's be you. So meaning be myself. And that's come for actually a couple of mentors. Well, like you said, I'm foreign. I'm a woman. And also on top of that, I'm not an engineer. I have a business background. So on paper, I'm not really meant to thrive in a mechanical engineering Finnish male dominant industry type of company. So in that sense, I perhaps had maybe filter is not the right word, but there was maybe times where I was still asking the questions and being annoying and stuff, but they were also part of me where I was like maybe filtering a little bit and or trying to keep my place. But in Finland, we have very flat hierarchy, and I think it came up quite soon when I started to have mentors that, hey, like, just be yourself. It's okay. Don't apologize all the time because you're not an engineer. Don't apologize because you're a woman, and don't apologize because you're a foreigner. Just be who you are and go with the flow. And I think that that has been really a great advice, because particularly women, I think we tend to, have a different approach to working life perhaps than men, especially when it comes to career advancement. And men are very confident, whilst we may not be. So I was told very early on, like, be you, be confident, be a career-oriented person, be whatever you want to be, but just be you. So that's a great advice, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. What is it? Shakespeare, to thine own self be true.
Yes.
who's the one leader you looked up to most, and why?
So again, apologize for the US audience and big part of the Europe, but I'm going to have to say Madame Simone Veil. She was a prominent French politician. She was a survivor of the Holocaust, and she had a great political career between the 50s and the 90s in different positions in French government and in the European. Authorities, and she was, of course, aiming to improve everybody's rights in France, but she did have a particular flair for women's rights, and I think she was always very humble, and she was always very efficient at the same time, and really did a lot of things for us women, and probably we are where we are today also thanks to her. So I think she's a very inspirational woman. To go through what she went through and still have the strength to carry on your whole life for others is something very inspiring, I
yes,
think.
Indeed, indeed. The servant leader.
I think yes, they, right? Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what's a personal habit that contributes to your success?
Well, I think coming back to this asking of the question, it's like in the end, I ask the question because I want to focus on the solutions and not the problems. And I think the personal habit of mine is that I continuously say, whichever workshop or meeting I am where people just dwell on the problems for more than they should, it's like, okay, let's stop talking about the problem. Let's talk about the solution. So it's kind of like very solution-driven attitude. And for some of these NGOs I mentioned earlier, that's also something that was one of the reasons why we created, for instance, this female network. Because on the internet, so much dwelling and keyboard warriors and all this kind of negativity everywhere. And we wanted to have some really focus, and in the media even. So we really wanted to focus on the solutions. And I think that's a habit of mine, that after 10 minutes, I'm bored with the problems. I'm like, okay, fine, got it. What do we do next? How do we fix this? So
exactly. I'm with you there. It's like you could only listen to the problem so much before any decision is almost a better decision than listening to it anymore.
Exactly.
There's a point where you're not making any progress. In the deliberations, there comes a point in exchanging the ideas and the observations and whatnot that progress stops, and now we're just complaining. And it's at that point we say, okay, we're not going to solve the problem, but we're going to take a step towards the solution. And I think that's important.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, so the last one, and I often ask this, but if you had one do-over, one thing that you could do completely differently or not at all, what would that be and why?
So I'm a big fan of yours, and I've been listening to your podcast, so I kind of knew that question was coming. So I started thinking that, okay, if I had, because I never asked myself the question before, I'm more like forward thinking than backward thinking, so I never thought about it. And I started asking myself the question, and the answer is actually nothing. I wouldn't take that card. If somebody would hand me a magic do-over card on a platter, I wouldn't take it. And I'm always amazed when your guests, they are able to pinpoint, the particular project or the particular thing in their life that they are able to say. And for me, nothing, because I would not be here otherwise. And I'm also a firm believer that if I had done, if I had avoided, let's say, a mistake or whatever, which I think is an opportunity to learn, it would have happened anyway later on. I think that, when you're messing up your first Agile project or you're messing up your first road mapping workshop or whatever it can be, there's always going to be the next thing that is going to be a new thing and that you will screw up as well, because it's learning journey. So no do-overs. I'm happy with all the lessons I've learned.
Well, I was enjoying this podcast right up until that moment.
Okay.
Because you have single-handedly destroyed that question for every guest in the future.
I'm terribly sorry, Joseph.
I don't know that I'll be able to ask another guest that same question ever again.
Of course you should. You
without
should.
Without getting that same answer, which
I'm
of
so
course
sorry.
Then I'll have to call them out on it. I said, "So you're a fan of my podcast and listen to Carolyn Bundier, eh? Yeah, all the way to the end."
Right.
Awesome. Great. Well, listen, that pretty much wraps up our episode of the podcast. I thank you very, very much for being my guest today. I loved the conversation, the engagement, and the story of your journey. So thank you for taking the time to be with me today.
I thank you very much, Joseph, for having me.
Excellent. So you've been listening to another episode of State of Readiness. Our guest today has been Carolyn Bondier, who's the Director of Process Development and Program Management at KONE. Thank you very much again, Caroline.
Thank you, Joseph.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.